This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss how to improve your health span with naturopath Dr. Colleen Hartwick. We'll learn about the omnivore's deception with philosopher and author Dr. John Sanbamatsu. We'll find out about healthy summer travel with naturopath Dr. Kate Hunter. And lastly, we'll discover the use of asking questions with social engineering expert and author Chris Hadnagy. Before we get to that, here's your Tonic Quick Shot. Vitamin D is more than just a nutrient. It helps your body take in calcium and phosphate for strong bones. It also supports your muscles, nerves, immune system, and cell growth. Now scientists have discovered a gene called SDR42E1 that plays a key role in how our bodies absorb and use vitamin D. In a new study, researchers found that this gene might also help cancer cells grow when they used a tool called CRISPR to turn off the gene in colon cancer cells. The cancer cells became much weaker and starved to die off. About 4,600 other genes also changed activity, showing how important SDR42E1 is. The exciting part? The gene could be a target for new cancer treatments that kill cancer cells but leave healthy ones unharmed. It might also help in other health problems related to vitamin D, like kidney disease or autoimmune disorders. However, scientists warn that we still need more research to fully understand how this gene works over time and to make sure treatments are safe. I'll be joined by Dr. Colleen Hartwick in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: the Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal, organic or wild-crafted. These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores. We've all seen shows lately that dive into aging and health. Shows like Limitless with Chris Hemsworth, for example, Live to 100, Secrets of the Blue Zones, And You Are What You Eat, Twin Experiment. There's been an undeniable shift in focus from just living longer to living better. So today, let's talk about health span. What exactly is health span and why is this concept so important, especially from a preventative health perspective? People are no longer just asking how long they're going to live, but how well they're going to live while they're living long. And that idea of health span, rather than just lifespan, is showing up everywhere. From documentaries to dinner conversations, joining me to discuss this topic is our regular guest and friend, Dr. Colleen Hartwick. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back. It's always a pleasure to be here to talk to you.
So this is a topic that's near and dear to me. I don't know about you, but we have family members who are getting up there in the years, and people are living longer, but I'm not convinced that they're necessarily living better. In other words, you know, what do those extra years that we're piling on, what do they look like and what can you do with them?
Yeah.
What do you think we mean when we say health span?
I think it's always an important place to start, just to like clarify terminology. Health span really refers to the total number of years people spend disease-free, where you're like my great-grandma who passed away at 94, still able to cook for herself, clean for herself. So living independently, you're mobile, you're mentally sharp and free from chronic illness. That's what we mean by health span, as contrasted by, I think, what's been the paradigm up until recent years. The focus was on lifespan, just how many years are you alive? We don't really care about the quality, the health. health span is really focused on how many years are you spending feeling vital and disease-free.
And it's what flows from it. Because if you're disease-free, then you're perhaps not spending money on medications or PSWs. So it's not just how long you're living and how well you're living, but how expensively are you living? Because not everything is covered.
No, it's absolutely true. And I'm seeing this with some newer patients who are in their latter years of life. They're running up against the fact that they're no longer in their working years and being hit with really expensive healthcare bills because they maybe weren't prioritizing the things that I think we're going to talk about today that would have increased the likelihood of them having a greater health span, not just a lifespan.
Right. Okay, so my origin story, and I know you know it, but for those who are new to the show, is I used to weigh 242 pounds. And when I was 38, I lost over 50 pounds. And I did that because I saw myself going down a bad path. I wasn't sleeping properly. I was sluggish. I wasn't feeling well. And I knew if I didn't fix myself, I was going to come up against health problems as I got older. So for those who are thinking, okay, this is a topic for people who are retired, I would say to you, no, I think this is something that we need to think about when we're younger. Do you agree about that?
Oh, 100%. I think it's come up in our previous conversations. What is the saying? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. You can start at any time and there's no better time than the present to start prioritizing your health and focusing on, again, expanding and extending that health span.
Okay. So let's start with something that we all do, and that is eating. What are some of the food habits that support a longer, healthier life?
Yeah, absolutely. I like to think about food as really the foundation of the house health, to use a corny analogy. What we eat on the day-to-day is going to impact what's happening first at the cellular level, but what happens at the cell expands out to the whole organism. So keeping it simple and keeping with eating lots of fruits and vegetables, we know that fruits and vegetables are really rich in fiber, which is crucial for gut microbiome, as well as rich in lots of micronutrients, vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, being sure to incorporate the quote unquote healthy fats, so the omega-3s, which really help to curtail inflammation, including legumes, lean proteins, avoiding the ultra processed foods and replacing them with complex carbohydrates like brown rice and sweet potatoes. And something I like to mention, and I mention more and more, making your diet rich in herbs and spices. I don't think they get as much attention as they deserve. Those flavor agents are rich in micronutrients, and they're among the top food ingredients that are the most concentrated source of antioxidants. And we know that oxidative stress is another process that can accelerate the aging process and essentially borrow from our health span.
So despite, you know, those of us who have a good diet or are doing 80-20 or whatever it is and making, you know, lifestyle choices, many of us still feel like we're missing something. Do you think that supplements play a role in bridging gaps or giving somebody a little bit of extra help?
Oh, absolutely. Again, food is the foundation, but supplements are there to supplement a well-balanced diet and for lots of different reasons, from agricultural practices, for example, the micronutrient density of foods. So the array of and the concentration of various different vitamins and minerals in our food is not the same as it was, 50, 60 years ago. So yeah, absolutely a time and place for supplements. And the vast majority of my patients are either already taking some supplements or through our work together have incorporated some key supplements. So some of my favorite foundational supplements are magnesium, because just about everyone is magnesium deficient. We know that magnesium plays a crucial role in helping to modulate our stress response, and high amounts of stress can accelerate aging and again borrow against that health span. Magnesium is also really critical for sleep, and as I'm sure we'll talk about, sleep is a key pillar to overall health. Then for those of us living further away from the equator, as we are here in Canada, vitamin D3 as well as K2, really critical supplements. Most people are not getting enough because they're not eating the organ meats like liver that are rich in vitamin D. We know vitamin D is super important for the immune system, for regulating inflammation. And the combination of the two, the D3 and the K2, so important for maintaining bone density and warding off against osteoporosis, The important omega-3s, the ones that we get from algae and cold water fish, EPA and DHA, really important both structurally for the brain, as well as important players for modulating inflammation. And I know I have a good proportion of patients that don't enjoy fish and so don't eat it very often. So they're not able to, through a whole foods diet, glean the benefit of those omega-3s. So supplementation serves as a nice stopgap to make sure that they're getting enough of those omega-3s, again, namely the EPA and DHA. And then CoQ10. CoQ10 is really important at the cellular level for producing energy. It's also really important as an antioxidant to reduce that oxidative stress. And as we get older, we tend to produce less CoQ10. And anyone who's taking a statin, that's the cholesterol-lowering category of drugs, statins deplete CoQ10. So if you're on a statin, I would give some very strong consideration to incorporating coenzyme Q10. A couple of other supplements, and these are more sort of whole foodsy supplements. I've got a good number of patients who know that they should eat more fruits and vegetables, but they don't really like them. Yep. So for those individuals, I'll usually recommend they incorporate some sort of superfood powder. So basically like freeze dried, dehydrated fruits and vegetables concentrated either in a powder or a capsule, and do that every day so that they're, again, gleaning the nutritional benefits of fruits and vegetables, but in a way that's accessible to them.
Okay, so let's shift gears because, that, you know, what we eat is just one aspect of how we keep ourselves healthy as we get older. Let's talk a bit about exercise and what types of exercise we should be doing as we get older.
Absolutely. So I think, again, we've had so many conversations at this point, so I'm kind of forget all the things I mentioned in the past that may have some new listeners. So exercise, it's huge, not just for physical health, but for cognitive health. Again, our muscles aren't just for mobility, they're protective. They help us with balance. And one of the things we get concerned about in healthcare for our older clients is a loss of muscle tone, a loss of balance, and an increased risk of fall, and with that, an increased risk of fracture. And some of your audience members may not realize that a bone fracture, especially in our older years, if that bone is osteoporotic, so really porous, there's a substantial increased risk of cardiovascular events after the fracture within a year, because there's a possibility of bone marrow escaping the fractured bone and getting into your cardiovascular system. Building strong muscles and with that building strong bones is really critical for increasing one's health span. So muscles, in addition to helping with balance, help us with blood glucose regulation, so it can be protective against things like insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes, helps us regulate our hormones, and also really important for cognitive health. Working muscles produce an important brain chemical called BDNF, which is like miracle grow for nerve cells, help those nerve cells build new connections, and also help to protect them from damage. And one of the best predictors of longevity, two things: grip strength, so how strong your forearm and hand muscles are, as well as strength in your quadriceps or your thigh muscles. So one of the things I recommend to all of my patients, irrespective of age, is incorporating some version of resistance or strength training. And that could be lifting your own weight. My favorite way to do that is rock climbing. You could do it in there with a personal trainer or in a yoga class or Pilates or doing CrossFit. And with that resistance training, ideally doing some body weight squats, because again, building big quads, that's been directly associated with improvements and in overall health span. In addition to resistance training, I think flexibility and balance training are also really important, because as I mentioned, the implications of a fall in our older years, we really want to be proactive around reducing the likelihood of that happening. So that could look like doing step ups and step downs on a box, right, to build those. They're called eccentric movements, essentially the breaks that help to prevent us from falling, or something like yoga, where you're doing standing postures to help build all of those stabilizing muscles.
So for many moons, I would go to a gym, you know, 5-6 times a week. And then COVID came around and there was the kibosh on that for about a year. And we ended up putting in a home gym. I have to say it was the best investment that we made, because now I have no excuse. It is particularly well outfitted for a home gym, I will say, but I can do weight training. I can do sort of CrossFit training. I can do whatever is necessary. And really, there's no excuse. Are you finding that your patients are doing the necessary resistance training?
they're coming around to it. I would say the vast majority of patients, especially when I include that bit of psychoeducation, so information about like why this is important, because a lot of people, I see a lot of women, and there's still sometimes some resistance around, you know, getting big and bulky. Yeah. But once they understand that, one, we don't tend to get that big and bulky without some additional help in the form of some drugs.
Yep.
But that helps with brain health, with bone density, and with metabolism. They're usually on board and either hire a personal trainer or get to the gym or find some version of resistance training, strength training that works for them. And I love what you did at home. I find reducing friction, so steps between thinking about working out and actually working out, that's hugely important for so many people. You want to make it as easy as possible so you can be successful.
Yeah. And you know, it's amazing. So like I'm pretty fit for my age and I use 35 pound weights. You can pick up a pair of 35 pound weights pretty inexpensively. Like most of my workout I can do on a mat with my 35s. And I think for most people, you know, you're not going to start at 35s. You're probably going to start at 10s, 15s, 20s. You can do a lot of resistance training with some simple dumbbells.
Absolutely. What I did in COVID, because climbing gym closed, yeah, and I picked up some resistance bands,
yep,
to use at home, and I still use them 5 years later. And I do what is known as exercise snacks. Like if I'm at home doing virtual appointments in between patient visits, I'll do some bicep curls, or again, having things easy and accessible at home, I think is just so important, because like you said, it reduces the load of excuses you can make. It's right there. So where's the resistance?
What's the downside? Yeah.
Yeah. Where's the resistance coming from, exactly, with your resistance training?
There you go. Well, I know there's so much more we want to talk about with HealthSpan. Will you come back next month and we'll talk about it some more?
Absolutely. I'd love to.
That was Dr. Colleen Hartwick. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the omnivore's deception. Cataracts are the leading cause of vision loss in adults over 50, but the good news is they're highly treatable. At Oakville Laser Eye Center, patients receive advanced laser cataract surgery with personalized surgeon-led care. Using cutting-edge technology and customized treatment plans, their expert team helps patients see clearly again to help them rediscover life's details. Book your consultation today at www.oakvillelaser.ca or call 905-337-3736. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
John Sambamatsu grew up in the South Shore of Massachusetts. He received his BA from Hampshire College and his PhD from the History of Consciousness Department at the University of California at Santa Cruz. He's currently professor of philosophy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, where he teaches ethics, existentialism, philosophy of technology, critical theory, animal studies, and other subjects. He's the author of the book, The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and Ourselves. He's also the editor of the anthology Critical Theory and Animal Liberation. When not teaching or writing, John could be found performing as a semi-professional magician. His other hobbies include fencing, tennis, chess, and being contrarian, a man after my own heart. Welcome to the show, John. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me, Jamie.
So The Omnivore's Deception, that's an interesting title. What is that? What does that mean?
Well, many people will recognize it as resonating with or echoing a famous book that came out in 2006 by Michael Pollan called The Omnivore's Dilemma. And partly the book is a response to the kinds of arguments that Michael Pollan, Temple Grandin, Barbara Kingsolver, and others have made concerning the animal economy and the role of meat in our diets. And the term deception really is referring to three kinds of deception. There's first of all the deception that the animal industry, meat, eggs, and dairy, fishing, and so forth, is perpetrating on the public by hiding, obscuring the mass violence that's involved in the animal system. Very few people, in my experience, have any idea of the scale of this thing. But we're talking about 80 billion land animals every year are being subjected to violence in the animal economy, and up to 2.7 trillion marine animals are killed each year. So that's one form of deception. The second is the one that I've already alluded to, which is the arguments of Pollan and others that we can have our meat and our conscience too, through a kind of humane, compassionate animal agriculture. And I show at great length why that isn't true. And the final mode of deception really is self-deception. We don't want to confront the violence and cruelty that we inflict on other beings, and we tell ourselves there's no choice but to go on consuming other animals, raising them in a way that's actually destroying the conditions of life on our planet. So that kind of sums up my approach in the book.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a bit. Humans have been eating other animals since probably the dawn of time, though, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Goes way back, yeah. So if the implication is, well, therefore we have to or should continue to do that, that's what we call a naturalistic fallacy in philosophy. Even if it were natural for us to engage in these behaviors, that wouldn't make it right. There are many things that are natural that are not, we don't judge to be good. You know, cancer is one of them, for example. So the argument in my book is simply that we have a choice. You know, we can choose to inflict this horrific scale of violence on other sensitive, intelligent beings, turning the whole world, as we have turned it, into a kind of gulag archipelago of mass suffering, or not, right? We can address the other beings of the earth with compassion and respect as they deserve, or we can continue on this path. So the fact that we've been engaged in this behavior for a long time doesn't mean that we need to do it. And in fact, it's no more natural to kill other animals than it is to download Netflix. These are cultural practices, and therefore they're subject to change if we choose to change them.
Well, I agree with you that it is a choice because we are sentient beings, but animals eat other animals, don't they?
Sure, some do. Not all do.
Not all do, but there are certainly animals who subsist on the flesh of other animals, right?
Yes. So say obligate carnivores like lions eat gazelles, for
right.
example. And if it were the case that lions were not obligate carnivores, they had a choice. Let's say they were omnivores, which simply means that, you know, an omnivore has evolved to be able to consume all sorts of things, metabolize things. If lions had the choice not to eat gazelles, and if moreover, you know, one lion said to another one day, hey, you know, Joe, I feel kind of bad about that gazelle we were eating. You know, I just saw terror in that gazelle's eyes. You know, maybe we shouldn't do this. And the other lion say, ah, Joe, come on. They're delicious. Just lighten up. Well, if those two conditions held, we would be in a position to level moral judgments against lion communities because the lions had a choice and they're in a certain sense making the wrong choice. So we are not obligate carnivores. And all the science shows that humans do better on average on a vegetarian, in fact, vegan diet than on a meat-based or omnivorous diet. I mean, lower rates of stroke, heart disease, type 2 diabetes. Vegans live longer than omnivores. So there's every incentive for us to change. But we have this attachment to our dominance on this planet, kind of as a species. And it's highly destructive. It's destructive to us, not only in terms of panzootic threats and pandemic threats and so forth, but also damaging to our souls, to our moral lives. Because the fact that we're doing this when we don't have to do it, the fact that we're committing acts of violence against beings that scientists have shown are highly intelligent, emotionally complex creatures, very much like us. The fact that we're doing that, it kind of poisons the meaning of a human life on this planet.
I respect somebody's opinion who's a principled vegan or vegetarian, so I understand that's where you're coming from. I don't know that I accept all the arguments that you've just made because, you know, and we cover nutrition extensively on this show. Like I've been covering health and wellness since 2007. I think the main culprit, which is leading to heart disease and the various environmentally driven diseases which we have, is the hyper-processed foods, which I think plays into a bit about, you know, industrialized farming and the mass scale. And I agree with you to the extent that the amount of meat that we eat is probably too much, more than we actually need to survive. But I don't think it's the consumption of meat that is driving, you know, diabetes or obesity. I think it's the way in which meat is consumed, because people had been consuming meat, you know, for untold centuries without being diabetic or without having heart disease. So I actually think it's our lifestyle that drives that and not the eating of meat. And I also, I'm not exactly sure that you're right that vegans live healthier. They can, but it requires a lot of extra help in order to get, for example, iron and protein and other nutrients into the system.
Well, if I may say so, I've been a vegan. Next year it'll be for 40 years. Mm-hmm. I'm 63. I look about 40. I do nothing special whatsoever. I don't disagree with you that hyper-processed foods can be unhealthy, but I'm talking about established science. I'm talking about studies in The Lancet, in JAMA, the top medical journals in the world that have consistently shown that vegan diets on average, again, offer great health benefits. But just to be clear, this is not a book about why, you know, we benefit nutritionally from giving up these animal products. What I'm talking about is a relation of domination, a relation of exploitation and horrible, sadistic violence against billions and billions and billions of sensitive creatures. I think that one of the problems with our society is we talk always through this kind of capitalist lens of, well, what's in it for me? How can I best maximize my individual health and so forth? But, you know, as a philosopher, I can only point to something Socrates pointed out or observed at his trial in Athens 2,500 years ago. And for those of you out there who don't know Socrates, who was an ancient Greek philosopher who was put on trial basically for asking annoying questions and invited to drink a chalice of poison hemlock. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that Socrates says at his trial is, look, you Athenians, in other words, his fellow citizens, you care more about wealth and power and your own selfish interests than you care about the goodness of your souls. That is really, that's the tradition I work in, and that's what my book is about. Even if it was the case, which it is not the case, even if it was the case that we are not at our healthiest on a vegan or vegetarian diet, and as I say, that is not the case, but even if it were the case, we would still have a moral obligation to cease and desist from inflicting violence on other sensitive, defenseless beings. There's simply no reason to do it. And by the way, it is literally undermining the conditions of life on this planet. The animal economy is the most destructive, ecologically destructive force on the earth. I mean, it's more destructive even than global warming, which it contributes to. So I understand where you're coming from, and I appreciate it. But I also feel like there are all these myths that you and I and others have been raised with to think that this system is inevitable. It's the best system we have. And really, my book is simply trying to get people to take a step back and look at this a little more objectively. And I think that if people read the book, they will be convinced by many of its arguments.
If people are interested in getting your book, where would they go?
Well, there's a very small little company that sells it called Amazon.com. And it's at booksellers. Go to your neighborhood bookstore. They probably carry it. If they don't carry it, please, by all means, ask them to start carrying it. It was just subject 2 days ago to a wonderful review in Forbes magazine. So I recommend that people are interested might just Google Omnivore's Deception and Forbes, and you'll see a review there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
That was a pleasure. Thank you, Jamie.
That was Dr. John Sembamatsu. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss healthy summer travel on The Tonic. Mm-hmm.
Cataracts are the leading cause of vision loss in adults over 50. But the good news is they're highly treatable. At Oakville Laser Eye Center, patients receive advanced laser cataract surgery with personalized surgeon-led care. Using cutting-edge technology and customized treatment plans, their expert team helps patients see clearly again to help them rediscover life's details. Book your consultation today at www.oakvillelaser.ca or call 905-337-3736. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wildcrafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lovers Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Dr. Kate Hunter is a licensed naturopathic doctor practicing in Ontario and the founder and owner of the Toronto Apothecary, a multidisciplinary clinic and wellness retail space in Midtown Toronto. Dr. Hunter offers a unique approach to naturopathy using auricular and bioenergetic medicine to support the body's self-healing abilities. She's dedicated to bridging the healthcare gap and providing care for marginalized communities. She also founded the Apothecary Wellness Foundation, offering free and sliding scale alternative medicine to low-income and marginalized folks in the community. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Kate. How you doing?
Good. How are you? Nice to chat with you again.
So summer vacation time. I'm about to leave on a Canadian road trip. I'm not going to the U.S. because, you know.
Right.
You know, yep. let's elbows up. I'm going to Quebec. And I saw your latest newsletter, which talked about healthy travel. And I thought, well, this is perfect. Not everybody's gotten away yet. We should probably give them some tips before they hop in the car or the plane.
Let's do it.
So let's start with something that people who tend to be, you know, going over time zones try and deal with, and that's melatonin. So what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, so melatonin is a really, really great sleep aid. So I don't necessarily prescribe it all the time to patients because I like the pineal gland to be able to upregulate it on its own. Melatonin is the conversion after serotonin, so technically it's a hormone. But I think in situations like travel where sleep can be greatly disrupted, I think it's a really great tool. I recommend folks, specifically if they're going to do an overnight flight, to take it like first thing when they get on the plane. It takes about 30 to 45 minutes to kick in, and it just really helps you get into that deeper sleep and stay, you know, in a more sleep state on the plane and not be woken up as often, which then just gives you a little bit more of a refreshed day when you land.
Do you encourage people to take melatonin? So let's say somebody was traveling to Europe. Would you encourage them to take the melatonin while they adjust to the time change, or is this mostly for flights?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the flight, I think, is the most important because that's where you really get in the sleep deficit. That's the beginning of the sleep deficit. So I think for sure on the plane, and then you can use it to regulate maybe the next 2 to 3 nights after that, just to get yourself, yeah, onto that time zone. So taking it before bed, you know, the prescriptions anywhere from 1 milligram to 5 milligrams. I find 3 milligrams is sort of the sweet spot and doesn't give you that grogginess the next morning, which sometimes melatonin can do.
So I know that some people object to melatonin because they feel that if it's used in the long run, the body stops producing it itself. And I know you're not talking about long-term use, but do you have any concerns about its use?
I think long-term, you just have to be careful with anything, but specifically something that is a hormone in the body. So I guess my concern around melatonin is that it's the conversion after serotonin. So if you're giving free melatonin at that end of the cycle, I think the caution or the fear is that your body doesn't then hold on to or upregulate serotonin as readily, which obviously we all know that serotonin is very important for mood regulation. So I think long-term concern with melatonin can sometimes be mood dysregulation.
Okay. So I intend to do, I do outdoor stuff when I go away in the summer, some hiking.
Awesome.
And do some other stuff. I don't know what you like to do, but I'm always mindful of hydration when I'm doing this stuff. So maybe you give some tips to people who maybe haven't turned their mind to like where they're going and how the climate might be different, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. I think hydration is the one that's most commonly forgotten, specifically with flight travel. I think most people like have the cocktail or, you know, get on the plane and, you know, have those little mini bottles of wine. But the flight itself can be so dehydrating. It's one of the most dehydrating things that you can put your body through. In traditional medicine, there's yin and yang, and yin is the most grounded sort of part, and then yang is the most ungrounded. And so flying is the most yang thing you can do for the body. So the most dehydrating, the most heat inducing. So preparing for that in advance, about 3 days in advance, and drinking a minimum of 3 liters of water, which I think most people think is a ton of water, but it just gets your body the reserves that it needs for something that is so yang like a flight.
Three liters of water, you better have an aisle seat. Is all I have.
Right? Exactly. You can also use electrolytes too to help like withhold that hydration, to help, you know, keep it in.
Right.
But a minimum of 3 liters of water is what's recommended before something that yang like a flight.
Okay. How does vitamin C fit into the picture?
Yeah, so vitamin C is one of those really easy vitamins to just use as a family. So I usually recommend it for people who are traveling as a family. Vitamin C for adults, the dose I'd recommend is around 2,000 milligrams, and for kids, around 500 milligrams. It's just a really easy thing to introduce. Usually there's chewables or even gummies, so it's easy for everyone to take. And it just helps bump your immune system up for anything like travel, because specifically with flying, the recycled air in the plane can make you more prone to infections.
Okay, so I supplement with magnesium daily, and I know there's different types of magnesium. So you advocate for magnesium citrate. Why magnesium citrate, and what does it do in this context?
So specifically magnesium citrate for travel. So magnesium citrate is the form of magnesium that is known to move your bowels. Magnesium glycinate is the amazing one that helps with muscle relaxation and deeper sleep. But citrate specifically helps for those people and those patients that get really constipated with travel, which I find really, really common in my practice. Again, because flying is so yang, it's so drying and dehydrating, it can really set people off for days and days of constipation.
Okay.
So I recommend magnesium citrate anywhere from 250 to 500 milligrams, and it just helps keep the bowels moving and bowel movements more frequent.
How far in advance would you recommend taking it if you haven't been taking it already?
It can sometimes react very quickly. So I would say taking it either, you know, the night of the plane, your actual flight, or the next day. So you can use it as you know, more of like a, if you are constipated, you can start it then. I think using it more of a prophylactic might cause some looser stools. So really just more after a flight into travel if you're feeling constipated.
Okay, so I joked about this before, but now with this comment, I really think it's important for people to go, you know, and book their aisle seats ahead of time.
Exactly.
And maybe even want to sit farther back in the plane, closer to the bathroom. I don't know, but I'm just
right, It's really safe to use specifically for people who know they're going to get constipated with travel. If this is a common symptom for you, you can use it night of travel, or just if you are feeling constipated, you know, randomly with travel, you can just use it sort of as you would, you know, like an Advil for a headache, you know, just for instant treatment.
Okay. So probiotics, I also take probiotics on the regular as well, but you have a specific purpose in this too, right?
So there are some really great probiotics that are specifically formulated to travel. So they include more strains. So a good probiotic should be human strain microflora. So not animal strain or plant strain, because human strain is actually going to recolonize a human system and really strengthen the microbiome. So probiotics that are formulated for travel usually have a lot of different strains because, you know, if you're coming into contact with different bacteria and viruses in different places that you don't commonly come into contact with, a really good travel probiotic with multi-strain will take this into account and have more strains than your average probiotic that you could get over the counter.
Sometimes I get stomach dysregulation when I'm traveling, and you kind of need something after the fact. And sometimes that happens when I'm here in Toronto. And I've been using probiotics after the fact as well to help calm the inflammation in the GI tract.
It works really, really well like that. Probiotics are great. You can use them long term. I think there's a lot of, you know, chit chat about how long you can use them. But if you bring them in and out of your regime like that, like if you have a bit of stomach upset, use them for about a month. You can go off for a certain amount of time if your bowels are great and your digestion's good. But I think around travel, just sort of setting yourself up for success and taking one the whole time, it also just helps your immune system, strengthens your microbiome, and basically just guarantees that you're not going to get super sick, specifically that traveler's diarrhea sick.
So when you were starting to talk about the probiotics, you mentioned, was it human strain versus animal strain? Or maybe I'm misquoting you.
Yeah, I think human strain is more important. So I think a lot of people, you know, think, oh, I eat kimchi or I eat yogurt, I'm getting enough. But it's not human strain bacteria. So it's not going to recolonize the microbiome. And I think specifically with travel, because you're introduced to so many different variants, viruses, bacteria, things that your system doesn't normally come into contact with, human strain is the most important to keep the microbiome really, really fit for something like travel.
And will that be on the label of the product? Will it say? I've never looked for that, those words, but are they on the labels?
You can use something like a multi-strand probiotic, or Genestra has a really great one called HMF Travel. So it's like a really broad spectrum multi-strand probiotic that encompasses all the different strains that you would need for something like travel specifically.
Right. I mean, the one that I was using sort of after the fact is Florastore, which I found worked for me very well. I wasn't familiar with the travel one from Genestra. That's interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of great ones. And I think now it's like quite generic to take a probiotic, which is awesome. I feel like everyone has much stronger microbiomes than say 20 years ago. But if you're trying to keep your system in check and make sure that you're not getting those things like traveler's diarrhea, a travel formulated human strain probiotic is what I would recommend.
Fantastic. Well, I wish you safe travels.
Thank you. You too.
Yeah. So what are you doing? What's your summer vacation?
We are actually just staying in Ontario for the summer. We're going to do a couple little road trips.
Nice.
But I sort of, you know, created all these tips from a couple of years of going to Europe. My husband is Italian, so I sort of like learned, you know, not necessarily the easy way that these things I definitely bring with me at all times.
Yeah, you ought to be careful drinking the water, even in Rome.
Even when you want to eat everything in Italy, you got to still be careful.
I totally hear you. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Okay, take care. Have a great summer.
That was Dr. Kate Hunter. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the use of questions on The Tonic.
I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
For over 40 years, the Big Carrot has been the community's go-to for fresh, local, and organic goodness. As a worker-owned natural food market, the Big Carrot is all about healthy living, sustainability, and bringing people together. They've got everything you need, from vibrant produce and bulk goodies to natural body care and wellness advice to keep you feeling amazing. And their kitchen and juice bars, serving up deliciousness every single day. Now, as they celebrate 41 incredible years, they're inviting everyone to join the fun. Head to thebigcarrot.ca to discover more, and follow them on Instagram at The Big Carrot for a chance to win big in their anniversary giveaways.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Christopher Hadnagy is a trailblazer in the realm of social engineering and a master hacker. His vast experience in the field, from training law enforcement professionals to speaking at renowned events like RSA and Black Hat, highlights his authority. He's the best-selling author of several technical books on security, including Social Engineering, The Art of Human Hacking. To find out more, visit his websites, www.socialengineering.com and www.humanhackingbook.com. Welcome back to the show, Chris. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me back. Doing good.
So I'm really good at asking questions because professionally I've done so as a talk show host for a number of years. But before that, I was a commercial litigator. So when I'm in court or when I'm doing interrogatories, I get to ask all kinds of questions. So I understand the power of questions, but maybe you can explain to our listeners why asking questions is a vital part of communication.
Yeah, so when you ask a question of a person you're communicating with, it activates their brain, which means that you're getting them involved in the conversation. And of course, there are many different types of questions. So certain questions activate the brain more and could even release chemicals like oxytocin, dopamine, things like that, that can get you engaged in building rapport with the person that you're communicating with.
How do you balance asking questions with actively listening in a conversation? Because, you know, as we've talked about previously, conversations are a two-way stream, not a one-way stream.
Yeah, that's a really, really important question, by the way, because I think active listening is a skill that we have to practice and that we have to really master, because it's not something that we just inherently have. You know, we're babies and children. The world is about us. It's about me when I'm an infant, right? So now you grow up and you got to do this thing called active listening, which is actually putting someone else first. So active listening, if we just define it first for anyone listening, it's listening with the intent of actually understanding, right? So it's not just listening so you can come up with your next sentence or the next thing you're going to say. It's listening with the intent that I want to know what you're thinking. So when we do that, we're not actually thinking about our next question or how we're going to rebut what's being said or add to what's being said. We're actually listening to that person because what's being said by them might change the whole nature of the conversation. So when you ask that question, just stop thinking about what's come next and just listen to what's being said.
It's a hard thing for me to do because I'm a really quick thinker. So I'm always jumping ahead to what my answer is going to be. And it's even harder, you know, as a host of a talk show, because I don't want to cut people off. I want to be polite, but I'm always thinking of the next question, right? Like that's just the way I operate. It's also informative. I think we can tell when somebody's just throwing questions out and not really listening to the answers. And I find that so offensive. Like somebody's just peppering you with questions and you can tell I don't know what the purpose is, but it isn't about having communication. It's about something else. I think it can be kind of obvious when somebody's not listening.
Yeah, especially if you're saying something and then they ask a question that is not really about the topic that you answered.
Right.
You can tell then that they definitely weren't listening to you and they have a track. They have a purpose in mind and they're going to go on that purpose. And now you said something that should change that conversation. And if it doesn't, that's a great sign that they are not active listening.
So what types of questions do you find most effective in sort of building relationships and rapport, or even understanding somebody better, because you emphasized understanding as part of active listening?
So open-ended questions do that the best, right? An open-ended question means that you can't answer it with a yes or a no, right? So that's a close-ended question that you can do just yes or no. Like, hey, do you like this food? That's yes or no, not open-ended. Whereas you say, hey, what do you like about this food? That's an open-ended question, because now the person has to think, well, what do I like about this? And they start to tell you. Now imagine we're having that conversation. We're out to dinner somewhere and you say, hey, what do you like about that food you're eating? And I say, oh, I love how spicy it is. And it has this, you know, really great texture. Now you're learning, oh, he likes spicy. You know, he has different textures of things that he gets into. That tells you a lot about what the person actually likes and what they're thinking about and what is in their motivation and their influence. So when you ask open-ended questions and you active listen, so now let's play that conversation out. You go, oh, so you really like spicy food, huh? Now you're building rapport with me because, oh, he heard what I said and he actually came back with a question about something I like. That releases dopamine, oxytocin. I'm starting to feel trust with you. And now the conversation can get deeper.
Do you adapt your questions depending on the context of the person?
100% have to, because sometimes, you know, especially let's think in my job, right? In my job, sometimes I want to use a close-ended question because I want to see nonverbals. Close-ended questions are great for reading body language, because if I ask you a question like, hey, do you like that meal? And you shake your head yes, but you shrug one shoulder. That tells me you're not really sure if you like the food. So if I cooked it, I'm going to be like, I'm not sure if he really likes it. He's just being polite, right? So I'll change that context if I want to use body language for reading people. But open-ended questions will tell you a lot about the person, and then you got to adjust the conversation. So that way, again, if I'm active listening, I'm not just going down the path I want. I'm going and saying, okay, this is what we need to talk about next.
As I'm getting older, I'm realizing the use of questions can be handy if you're in a conversation with somebody who's feeling hard done by or aggressive, or it's a difficult conversation. Sometimes you can't get your point across simply by stating it, but allowing that person to come to your perspective by asking them a question which challenges their perspective and gets them to articulate it. Does that make sense?
I love that. I love it. And it's very effective. And especially if someone's angry and you can control your emotion, and then you can start off with a question like, "Man, I see you're getting very upset. Can you tell me what I did that is making you so upset?" Now they have to stop and actually explain what's irritating them. And I find that when I do that, and I'll just use my marriage as an example. When I do that with my wife, then she stops and explains, it might be something I didn't even know I did.
Right.
You know, like, well, I was just talking to you and you didn't even answer me. And I'm like, well, you were? Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I was reading social media and I didn't even hear what you said. And I'm like, I'm sorry, you know, and now all the anger goes away because I didn't even know what I did. Where if I responded with, "Hey, what are you raising your voice at me for? You know, come on, shut up." Right. That's not very polite or nice. And now I'm going to instigate more anger. But by starting off with that question, I can now alleviate that anger and return to a normal conversation.
I think the most powerful question is why. Like, why are you doing that? Why do you feel that way? Why do you think that I did this? Why do you suppose that you're right about that? Like, to me, that is the most disarming question you can ask somebody.
It is. Now, with one caution, you can't use why too many times in a row.
Why?
At once, because it seems exactly because it seems like an interrogation instead of a conversation.
Well, that's my old, you know, commercial litigator coming out.
Yes.
But you know, a good interrogatory, you never ask a question you don't know the answer to already. And sometimes you tend to ask closed-ended questions because you can control the answers much more. Like if I'm trying to control a conversation, I will use a closed-ended question. When you're using open-ended questions, I am trying to change the tone of the conversation to greater effect. I think if you're speaking with somebody whose cognitive abilities are in decline or not great to start with, sometimes those questions can be more helpful. That's my experience. Is that yours?
Yeah, and I would agree. And I do agree with you that this is a very lawyer-like thing. Every time I've been in a deposition or something, and it's the opposing counsel, let's say, they always ask these very, what sounds like an open-ended but is very closed-ended question. Like, can you understand how maybe someone might be irritated by this thing?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, of course you have to say yes to that, right? Because yes, I can understand how someone might be irritated by this thing. And then it's like, okay, so you're saying this, that you understand that people are irritated at you. Like, what? What? No, that's not what I said, you know?
Exactly.
That's not a conversation. That's more of a trap, right? So I say, when you're trying to have a conversation, don't do that. Even if it's like, let's say your child and they did something wrong and you're trying to find out why they did it. When the person feels trapped, then you ruin all types of rapport building, no oxytocin, no dopamine. It just kind of feels bad.
I agree with you. And I, you know, I would like to add, I don't enter into every conversation with a lawyerly perspective that I'm trying to elicit specific information. You know, it's, you know, most people have conversations to further relationships or find out information, but like it isn't necessarily, you know, as Machiavellian as getting a specific response.
Yes.
Have you ever encountered a negative response from asking a question? And if so, how do you handle that?
Yeah. So I think we've all made mistakes before, like where I feel like I'm building rapport and then I ask a question that maybe is more personal than the level of rapport that we've built and had people kind of get taken back like, whoa, man, we're not there. You know, kind of you could see it in their face. Like, what are you doing? So what I do with that, and this is a really delicate situation, because if you're good at reading people, you can't say, "Ooh, I see, I just offended you by the way your body language." You know, you can't do that because that feels even worse. You know, people feel like you're non-verbally pantsing them, right? Like you're exposing their emotion that they think they're so good at hiding.
Yep.
So what I do is I kind of take ownership of it. I'm like, "Ooh, that question was a little bit too deep, right? I mean, sorry about that. I don't know where that came out of," and kind of take ownership of it and hopefully get some kind of humor. Humor dispels those negative emotions, but it has to be self-deprecating humor at that point, not humor about that person or something else. You kind of got to like self-deprecate a little, like, "Oh man, I'm always putting my foot and my leg in my mouth. You know, sorry about that," kind of, and then move on.
Men are not. Self-deprecation, which I use to great effect, is not a masculine trait. And I think women are better communicators because
they can step away from that aggression. It's a rare male who specializes in self-deprecation. I would say that.
I would agree. And it takes practice. And one of the reasons for that is women have naturally have more empathy.
Yep.
And they're not always competing to be the best in the room. So when you have I teach this, I love this topic, and I can talk for hours on this. I tell men, practice the art of ego suspension.
Yeah.
If you can practice that, you will be one of the best communicators on the planet, right? And ego suspension isn't saying, you know what, Jamie, I'll let you be right. That's not ego suspension.
No. Nope.
Ego suspension is literally having the ability, like you said, to self-deprecate and to suspend the fact that I think I know everything and to learn from other people, willingly, openly learn from other people.
I think it's inviting when you express to somebody that you see your own flaws, that you are able to be self-actualized and to see yourself as you are. It allows them to be who they are.
I would agree 100%. Remember, we have mirror neurons, and not only that, but we do a lot of mirroring of people when we build rapport. You'll find it when you're in person, if you're building rapport, if you cross your legs, that person will cross their legs, so on and so forth. But that also goes with the flow of the conversation.
Yep.
If you're talking in a way that is ego suspending and that you're owning your flaws, then that person's going to feel more comfortable doing the same thing. And that can make the conversation like just unbelievable if you think about it. Like, picture a time when you were in a conversation that was that good. You probably could still remember it and the emotions you had with it.
I do. And I have one more question for you, if that's okay.
Yes,
and,
please.
And that is, will you come back and we can explore more about questions the next time you're on?
I would love to. This is a topic I really enjoy.
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Colleen Hartwick, Dr. John Sambamatsu, Dr. Kate Hunter, and Christopher Hadnagy. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.